that I can understand it. It doesn't mean that it
is clear that I'm doing that.
So, let's keep it here.
Yeah, so stay tuned until another episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's program, we'll be discussing the US interference in Bangladesh's upcoming polls and Chabahar Port's strategic importance for India. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss US, China, and the election in Bangladesh. And we shall also take a look at the geopolitical significance of Chabahar Port to India.
America has historically had an involvement in the change of governments in countries across the world where it either deems the elected government as authoritarian and in need of the so-called democracy or unsupportive of the US interests. Foreseeing an imminent interference, the Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina, has said in Parliament that the US is trying to eliminate democracy in the country and introduce a government that will not have a democratic existence. Thus, it will be an undemocratic action.
In the year 2021, the US levied sanctions on Bangladesh's paramilitary force, the Rapid Action Battalion, and six of its senior officials, accusing them of human rights violation. The U.S. State Department also imposed visa sanctions on some Bangladeshi officials. Foreign affairs analysts say that the new visa policy that restricts visas for any Bangladeshi national regarded to obstruct a fair election process in the country shows Washington's exasperation with Dhaka. Historically, the United States has been overtly involved in overthrowing governments in Cuba, Hawaii, and some Caribbean countries. However, now with the help of its intelligence agency, the CIA, the operations have assumed a clandestine status. These interventions in the foreign countries have been governed by many factors. While the U.S. claims to be helping people to promote human rights and restore democracy, the selfish game of Washington has been globally witnessed more often than once. Global competition for influence has also been the governing factor. Washington is trying to reduce the influence of its global rival, Beijing. America has geopolitical interests in Bangladesh. Washington wants to use the valuable resources, trade routes, strategic location of the country for its interests, in turn interfering and damaging the democratic institutes of the South Asian country.
Strengthen trade and investment with China, Beijing has emerged as Dhaka's biggest trading partner with bilateral trade at around $10 billion. Being strategically important, Bangladesh is one of the largest recipients of China's Belt and Road Initiative as well. However, the U.S.-China rivalry is having an impact on the country's political and economic scenario in the wake of targeted sanctions by the United States against the country's Rapid Action Battalion. China has come out to openly support the Bangladeshi government.
Over the last decade, Bangladesh has seen an expanding economy, higher foreign investment, decreasing poverty, and significant strides in human development. With a successful term in office, Sheikh Hasina's government is planning to hold elections early next year, with China supporting the decision. Criticizing the U.S. interference in Bangladesh, China has said that it denounces all forms of hegemony and power politics. The United States, however, is again trying to exercise its hegemonic behavior in the fast-evolving multipolar world order. In contrast, India, being Bangladesh's immediate neighbor, has issued no official statement regarding the upcoming elections in the neighboring country. The Indian diplomatic mission in Bangladesh has restrained its activities compared to previous elections, where India was seen engaging with civil society, political parties, and the press. Eyeing the South Asian country's poll scheduled for January next year, the U.S. officials are frequenting the country. The global financial risk analysis firms have asked their investors to be prepared for government change in Bangladesh. Analysts believe that the increasing tense relations between Bangladesh and the United States reflect Washington's urge to counter the influence of its superpower rival, China. Meanwhile, the upcoming elections will determine the political landscape and regional dynamics of the country.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by geopolitical analyst Mr. Sayed Muhammad Ali from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
More than welcome. Now, sir, let me begin by this. America has recently announced that it's their duty to promote democracy in the world, also mentioning visa restrictions for people trying to undermine democracy in Bangladesh. So I wanted your opinion on this hegemonic attitude in what we are witnessing, this quickly evolving multipolar world.
Thank you very much. It's a very important question. I think the American policy can be understood in five ways, and that will help us understand what's going on regarding its policy towards Bangladesh and other countries, including Iran perhaps as well. I think it is understandable that they want to maintain their dominance in the international system in five domains. The first is obviously the value system or ideology. The second is the political system. The third is their economic system and their currency dominance. The fourth is the diplomacy and law fair, which you see in terms of international regimes and treaties. And the last and the fifth domain is the security domain, in which they want to maintain their dominance in terms of security. So when you look at Bangladesh, when you see some concern or pressure regarding its political system, then obviously it should be seen in the context of not just the value system, because you know Bangladesh, like Iran, like Pakistan, and so many other countries, is a Muslim majority country. And all Muslim majority countries have a common interest in reducing and recovering from the Western dominance and exploitation. And they see the Chinese investment and engagement as a ray of hope to reduce the Western exploitation and dominance.
Sayyid Muhammad Ali, what about the Bangladeshi Prime Minister's comments? He has said that the U.S. wants to change the government in the country. So how do you look at America's history of interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states?
I think since Second World War, you will perhaps agree, there are at least more than 50 countries around the world in which political interference was a reality and attempts of changing regime is a historical fact all over the world, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America. That is an unfortunate reality of the world. So if a developing country does not follow the desired policies of the Western powers, regime change is an option that they consider. It is another matter whether they are successful or not. But in case of Bangladesh as well, they are facing three challenges. First is the domestic political challenge. The second is the regional challenge. And the third is balancing its relations between China and the U.S.
Now, what about how are the growing ties between the two countries going to affect Dhaka's relations with Washington?
I think if you look at Bangladesh's relations with the U.S. and China in three domains, security, economy, and foreign policy, then you will agree that Bangladesh followed a relatively degree of neutrality between China and the U.S. It did not take sides in any major issue against the U.S. or China. However, it is facing a lot of pressure to resist Chinese investment and growth. And you know, China is the biggest investor right now and also a bigger export market for Bangladeshi goods. So I think it is going to be very difficult for Bangladesh to choose sides, because U.S. is a large export market for Bangladesh, but it also wants to attract Chinese investment and trade with Beijing. So I think it will be very difficult, because you know very well the U.S. style of politics is very different from Chinese model. U.S. China believes in investment, joint venture, without interference in domestic politics. But the Western powers use all tools, including coercion, including pressure, including sanctions, to force the developing world to follow its policies.
Now, before we let you go, sir, in view of the Indo-Pacific strategy and Belt and Road Initiative, Bangladesh, obviously we know, holds importance for both China and America. So how do you see Dhaka's foreign and economic policies unfolding in the coming years?
I think I've witnessed Bangladesh's approach has been that of balancing its relations between China and the U.S. for two reasons. One, it wants to attract Chinese investment, development, infrastructure development, and also build China as a large export market. However, it is constrained because U.S. is a large export market for Bangladeshi products. And you know, Bangladeshi exports have done remarkably well in the recent past. So that's why, driven by this economic compulsion, they are not taking a clear side, despite the fact that the U.S. style of foreign policy is far more aggressive and interventionist as compared to China, which relies primarily on soft power, economic interdependence, and investment.
Thank you, sir. Now let's turn to social media and see what people are saying.
Geoffrey McDonald, a visiting expert on South Asia at the U.S. Institute of Peace, tweeted, Bangladesh State Minister for Foreign Affairs calls U.S. Congressperson enemy of Bangladesh for their letter to the White House criticizing Bangladesh's human rights record. Stanley Johnny, author and foreign affairs editor at The Hindu, tweeted, the U.S. has announced a visa denial for select Bangladesh officials who they say could undermine the country's elections. Why the Americans are after Sheikh Hasina and the Awami League? Mahmoudul Khan, a human rights defender and social media activist, tweeted, Somalia, Nigeria and now Bangladesh. New U.S. visa policy before general elections and insult to Bangladesh.
Following Iran's official membership of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Indian Prime Minister has said that Shanghai Cooperation members can work towards maximizing the utilization of the Chabahar port. While conveying his best wishes to President Raisi, Prime Minister Modi emphasized the importance of better connectivity, regarding it crucial for the progress of any region. The Chabahar port has been anticipated as a significant trade route for India, providing access to Afghanistan and Central Asia. However, the partnership between Iran and India has been marked by a series of delays and challenges.
The Indian Prime Minister has recently said that the international north-south transport corridor can serve as a secure and efficient route for landlocked countries in Central Asia to access the Indian Ocean. He stressed that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization member countries should strive to realize its full potential.
As the Prime Minister has said, Iran's membership of SCO is a very important event for us. And of course, even more important is our bilateral relationship with Iran. With Iran having become member of SCO, there will be more users for the Chabahar port.
The Chabahar port transit project is of great importance in the international north-south transport corridor. The collaboration between Iran and India at Chabahar port began in 2016, with India committing a substantial investment of $500 million. The aim was to establish a seaport that would serve as a gateway for Indian goods to reach the landlocked countries of Central Asia and Afghanistan. Deteriorating Iran-U.S. relations and the subsequent reimposition of sanctions on Tehran in 2019 disrupted the project's momentum. Washington, in its efforts to exert pressure on Iran, adopted a policy that discouraged countries from engaging in significant trade and investment activities with Tehran. India also faced political pressure to limit its engagement with Iran. Fear of potential repercussions, sanctions, and strained diplomatic relations forced New Delhi to tread cautiously in its dealings with Tehran. Consequently, the project experienced delays in contract implementation, equipment procurement, and overall progress. Despite the setbacks, a portion of the required equipment, worth $24 million, including heavy-capacity mobile cranes and ancillary equipment, was successfully procured. The completion of pending contracts and the resolution of financial and geopolitical hurdles remain critically important for the timely development of the Chabahar port. The Indian government's ability to navigate the complex political dynamics while ensuring the country's economic interests will play a crucial role in overcoming the existing delays.
Strategically positioned, the Chabahar port holds promising future for India's regional trade. It not only has a potential to ensure a reliable and independent trade pathway, but also grant India seamless access to the vast markets of Asia and Europe. Capitalizing on Chabahar's strategic location, India can bolster its trade ties with the Central Asian countries, tap into resource-rich regions, and strengthen economic partnerships across the globe.
India's commitment to the project holds the key to unlock an array of opportunities for trade, connectivity, and regional cooperation. Chabahar's potential to bridge connectivity barriers provides neighboring countries with an opportunity to utilize Iran as a transit route, promoting regional connectivity and trade. As China seeks to expand its Belt and Road Initiative project, Beijing's growing influence in the Middle East raised concerns for New Delhi. In consideration to its 25-year partnership with Iran, China's presence in the region poses a potential challenge for India's interests in Chabahar. The comprehensive partnership between China and Pakistan, encompassing defense, security, and substantial investments, presents a formidable force that India cannot afford to overlook. Failure to capitalize on this opportunity would not only hamper New Delhi's regional trade prospects, but pose significant challenges to India's access to Asian and European markets, in turn affecting its economic growth and limiting its influence globally. Resolving financial hurdles and finalizing pending contracts would secure India's position as a vital player in the regional trade and cement its influence in the ever-evolving dynamics of the Asian continent.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by University Professor Dr. Sayed Ali Akhtar from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Dr. Akhtar.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, let's begin with Prime Minister Modi's recent comments. He mentioned that Iran's SCO membership can help to maximize the use of Chabahar port. So my question is, can we expect immediate developments with regard to the completion of the port project in the near future?
Yes, I think there is a great potential in the Chabahar port, and it is a win-win situation for both India and Iran. As you can see that the recent talks between Iran and India is going on, so India has committed also to $25 million initial commitment for the Chabahar port. Initially in 2016, they promised about $500 million, but it is an initial amount. Another positive sign that I see for the, you know, for the expedited development in the Chabahar port is that Indian Reserve Bank of India has also agreed to the rupee transaction between Iran and India with regard to the Chabahar port. And especially India's resumption of wheat export to Afghanistan is also a good development in this regard. So as far as the current situation is in India, I can see that the central government has given a green light to this project, and India is soon going to invest in Chabahar port in order to be able to have a regional strength against China and Pakistan economic corridor, or against the, you can say, the Gwadar investment of, Gwadar port investment of, China.
That's right, sir. Now, Dr. Akhtar, ending the Chabahar deadlock, as we know, can promote both the countries economically. So to what extent will it advance India's regional influence and international economic standing?
So as you can see that the Central Asian countries are generally landlocked countries, and India's their route to the west is not possible, and India's actually route to the western countries is not possible without the Gwadar port. And Gwadar basically is based in Pakistan, India's arch rival, as you can see. I think Indo-Iranian relationship via Chabahar port will give some regional power to India also, and it will open ways to connect to the rail and through the seaport, through which they can connect to the Afghanistan, they can connect to Iran and other Central Asian countries. So I think the why Mr. Modi, the current Prime Minister Mr. Modi, has hailed this Iranians joining SCO organization is because of the fact that both India and China are part of it, and Iran could play Iran could actually become a balancing power between India and China.
Thank you, Dr. Akhtar. Now, you mentioned China's presence in the region, which poses a potential challenge to India's interest in the Chabahar port. So how do you think can India mitigate this challenge and safeguard its position as a key player in regional trade and connectivity?
Actually, I think the issue is that India's connectivity with other countries was not possible without the Gwadar port. Chabahar port will actually bring stability in the sense that there will be an alternative route to connect to the other countries, and it will also help India trade with countries like Iran, where they can trade in rupee and they can have some discounts. Although China is also interested in Chabahar port, which is still which is still a problem for India, but I think that Iran could work. Iran could actually serve as a mediator between two rival countries in this region, and both the countries can safeguard their interest in that sense. So I mean, India could enhance its regional power by bypassing Gwadar port through Chabahar port. That is my understanding of it.
That's right, sir. Now, before we let you go, sir, now congratulating Iran on its SCO membership, Prime Minister Modi said that better connectivity enhances mutual trade and fosters mutual trust. So how has the relationship between Tehran and New Delhi emerged in recent years?
Actually, when I started my LLM in 2016 May, that is when the project got traction. The Chabahar project got traction, in which Indian Iranian Prime Minister actually visited India, and they had a mutual setting of saying that, you know, that India is going to invest $500 million. But as you can see, that the later development and Iran's strained relationship with the United States and the economic sanctions imposed upon it, the trade went below. As I can show you the figure, that India, Iran were trading $17 billion in 2018 and 19, but it fell in 2021 and 21. It dropped to $1.9 billion because of the sanctions. So the economic sanction by the United States in Iran not only affected its relationship with Western countries, but it affected the relationship with countries like India also. But now, as we can see, that the trade between the two countries are going to be restored, and that could be the first step towards it. So I think the major roadblock for it was the sanction issue, and Indian companies were also unwilling to invest in this project because they were fearing secondary sanctions by the United States.
That's right, sir. Now, you've mentioned sanctions, so I have to ask you this question. What are they doing, or these the countries are doing, to bypass these sanctions?
The countries that are, the countries have adopted certain measures to bypass the sanction. One of the ways in which Iran has bypassed the sanction is to trade in the currency that is not USD. So you can see that India's Reserve Bank of India last year agreed to transact in the Indian rupees in the Chabahar project. That bypasses the whole international financial system, and that is, I think, a good step to counter economic sanctions against the countries. I have done research in economic sanction, and I have always taken this view that unilateral sanctions on economic sanctions are prohibited and are actually violative of international law. That is my conclusion. I have published several pieces in this regard. And my hunch is that that this Eastern partnership, you could say, between Iran, India and other countries, is also a kind of challenge to the Western hegemony in this regard. And that could also potentially open up ways for the Eastern ways of, for doing trade and making connectivity. So I think bypassing sanction, introducing a rupee as a currency has bypassed the whole system of the sanctions that has been imposed. This is my understanding.
Thank you, sir. On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Akhtar for being on the program. He is the professor of international law from New Delhi. Thank you for being with us, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, let's see what people have said on social media.
Vivek Y. Kelkar, writer and a journalist, tweeted, "The international north-south transport corridor offers India not only a gateway into Central Asia, but a link into Central Europe and beyond. All lines of the INSTC pass through Iran, making the Chabahar port critical, but the US-Iran issues cast a shadow." Lord of Destruction, a netizen whose bio says an Indian patriot, tweeted, "Exactly, China increased its influence in Iran because we had to limit our trade with Iran due to US sanctions. It even affects our Chabahar port project in Iran, which could give an alternative to China's Gawadar port in Pakistan." Sheena Kiara, an economist from Qatar, tweeted, "With Iran's Chabahar lying in limbo due to sanctions on Tehran, long-term Indian ambitions for regional connectivity and trade have been badly affected." Ahmed Shuja, an author and lecturer at Deakin University, Australia, tweeted, "We knew from Chabahar that sanction exemptions alone are not enough, because jittery banks aren't willing to touch sanctioned entities with a 30-foot pole. This technical solution needs political confidence building to maximize the benefits of humanitarian carve-out."
And that was our episode on Washington's meddling in the domestic affairs of Dhaka and the Chabahar port, an area of strategic convergence between Iran and India. We shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take great care. the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The French police has gained remote spying powers. A new law in France allows authorities to activate the cameras and microphones of suspects' cell phones. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, police in France has gained the power to remotely activate and monitor the camera, microphone and GPS of a suspect's devices under a so-called justice reform bill that passed the National Assembly recently, according to media reports. The legislation, which passed with a majority of 80-24, allows the French police to use laptops, cars, phones, and other connected electronics in order to monitor suspects, as well as those suspected of organized crime and delinquency. The bill reportedly includes exemptions for sensitive professions such as journalists, judges, lawyers, doctors, and MPs. Lawmakers with President Emmanuel Macron's party added an amendment limiting remote spying to when justified by the nature and seriousness of the crime and for a strictly proportional duration not exceeding 6 months. Police will only be able to use geolocation when investigating crimes that carry at least a 5-year prison sentence, and a judge must sign off on every use of the powers. The new measures raise serious concerns over infringement of fundamental liberties. Digital rights advocacy group La Quadrature du Net said in a statement. It claimed that the right to security, right to a private life, and to private correspondence hung in the balance, as well as the right to come and go freely. Because the bill is vague about what constitutes a serious crime, the government could use the new police powers to silence political activists and others who pose no real threat to the state, the group argued. The Paris Bar, a professional group of 30,000 lawyers, warned in a statement that the bill constituted a particularly serious breach of respect for privacy, arguing it cannot be justified by the protection of the public order and complaining it not prohibit police from snooping unprotected conversations between lawyer and client. Insisting the new police powers would only be used on dozens of cases a year, Justice Minister Eric Dupond-Moretti argued. adding, people's lives will be saved by beefed up surveillance. He said, we are far away from totalitarianism of 1984. The justice reform bill passed the Senate last month in its original form and now must be approved as amended. Last week, France erupted into massive violent riots following the police shooting of 17-year-old Noël Merzouk as he allegedly attempted to flee a traffic stop in Nanterre. The officer who shot the youth was arrested and charged with voluntary homicide. In response to the violence, which has led to over 4,000 arrests across France, with 1,200 of those estimated to be minors, Macron has proposed a social media kill switch to prevent young people from coordinated actions. The website of Vion also reported in what appears to be a major plot point of George Orwell's critically acclaimed 1984 novel, the French government has passed a law that allows police to spy on people through their phones. As part of a wider justice reform bill, the French lawmakers in National Assembly passed a bill that lets police surveil suspects by remotely activating cameras, microphones, and GPS location systems on their phones and other devices. A few caveats, however, have been added to stop the government from becoming a full-blown authoritarian state. To surveil any suspect, a judge will have to approve the use of special powers, and the total duration of surveillance cannot exceed 6 months. Moreover, the said powers cannot be used against journalists, lawyers, MPs, and other sensitive professions. Notably, the Senate had greenlit the provisions of the Justice Bill last month. However, after the new amendments were introduced recently, the proposal will be sent back for approval before it can become law. The timing of the passing of the bill could not have been worse, experts argue. Currently, the entire country is facing a sea of protest after a 17-year-old was shot by police in a Paris suburb. After the incident, the turmoil across France forced President Emmanuel Macron to postpone his visit to Germany. The state visit was scheduled to begin on July 2nd at the invitation of German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we try to answer your questions and queries you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Naqvi, who's an Islamic scholar and a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, Qom, Iran. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Well, we have been talking about technology and its impact on the teenage upbringing, and Professor Salman Naqvi has been helping us. Yes, Professor, what would you like to share with the parents today who are dealing with the teenagers in this tech world?
Yes, as we have been saying all along, that technology should be at the service of mankind. It should be for the benefit of mankind, not the other way around. Yes, we have doomsday scenarios where the machines are going to take over the world and everything. Human beings will be ruled by machines. I mean, it is a possibility, but it's a very remote possibility. It just goes to show to us and demonstrate to us that we need to stop this happening if this
exactly.
could happen.
Again, the same thing, that the tools that we created, we should not become tools of those tools.
Exactly. I mean, there should be some moral authority, and there should be some moral requirements which stop us using technology in a way which is going to be reprehensible, which is going to be something which is going to end up in a very wrong way. For example, now when we're talking about cloning or genetical engineering, so there's great advancement in this. And stem cells research is going on in many places, like in the Islamic Republic of Iran. They're also progressing quite extensively in this field.
Swiftly, yeah.
And these are one of the cutting edge technologies that are in vogue today in the world.
Yeah.
Now, so it's for treatment of many diseases. This is going to help us.
Yeah.
For example, even infertility can be taken care of by this research. Or, for example, even many children who are going to be born into this world with defects, natural defects, maybe that can also be somehow
cured
or prevented or whatever. Even maybe tomorrow you could be able to select what gender of child you want. Maybe that would be possible. But there are some limits to it. I mean, tomorrow genetical engineering you can come up with a monster, a cross between a human being and a technological monster. So this is possible. It is within the possibility of mankind to do this, but it is morally wrong. It is something which is going to take us to a disaster.
Right.
So technology has to advance, has to progress, but within limits, within moral limits, within ideological limits. What is allowed, what is not allowed, has to be taken care of. For example, when we talk about the nuclear bomb, atomic bomb, now there's no doubt about it that nuclear technology is very important for mankind. Our children nowadays know about it. Nuclear technology helps in medicine, helps in agriculture, it helps us in generating energy. So tomorrow our children should know that it is going to, these are one of the fields that they can go into. But then again, the nuclear bomb, the hydrogen bomb, the plutonium bomb, they are also the negative aspects that are not allowed. They are morally disallowed.
Right.
Therefore, we have this ruling and this fatwa of Imam Khamenei, who has very explicitly banned the production of mass weapons of
destruction.
Mass destruction.
Right. So, Professor, we'll be discussing more with you after a short break. Now, listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. We have Professor Salman Naqvi with us, and we are discussing the impacts of technology on teenage upbringing.
So this is the, I was discussing the moral aspects, the ideological aspects, the religious aspects of technology. We need to teach our children and the what's the good about it, what's the
evil, what are the bads, what are the goods,
the religious edicts about it, the limits which have to be taken care of. They should learn about it, so tomorrow if they have been trained, if they have been educated, they have been, their upbringing has been based on moral principles, on religious principles,
right,
then certainly when they become into contact with this technology, whether it's for their personal benefit or it's for the benefit of other human beings, they employ it in their lives. They know what the limits are. They should know that. Otherwise, those people who created the nuclear bomb, if they had been educated morally, they would have resisted.
Right.
They would have resisted the authorities who were making them, paying them to build that bomb.
Right.
So you can't say the scientist who was behind this theory, who discovered nuclear technology or the nuclear aspects or the potential in that field. But those who went to create that technology and created the weapons of mass destruction, they are those human beings who have not been educated morally. Yes, they are offered money, they are offered resources to carry out wrong things. So if our children are taught and educated, look, you're not supposed to do anything for the sake of money. Even if somebody gives you money, gives you a lot of wealth and a lot of money to build something which is destructive, to do something which is destructive, which is murderous, which is destroys mankind,
right,
then he or she should resist that.
Right.
And that temptation should be, stopped. It should be resisted. So this comes with proper upbringing. It
right.
comes from childhood. But if mm-hmm. child in the childhood, the proper upbringing is not there, a child becomes, he lives with anxiety, with stress, and his feelings and emotions are, they are suppressed, and he wants to do anything he likes in the future.
Right.
So the important thing for our parents is that they should be able to teach their children how to engage with this
technological world.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's really very important, because if we lose that track of recognizing what problems our teenagers are facing while dealing with the tech, maybe it would be difficult then to cure that, because as soon as the disease is recognized, it could be cured at early. We'll discuss more with you, Professor, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we have Professor Salman Naqvi with us. Well, Professor, do we have any technology in itself? We have been discussing for several sessions now, it has positive impact, it has negative impact. But does it have any particular negative impact that parents really need to be concerned about?
Yeah, I think anything that you get addicted to, and it becomes a habit, and you can't you cannot change that habit. That's the difficult thing, especially we all of us. For example, when there's a phone, Android phone or a smartphone in front of us, we're prone, we become habituated to, you know, all the time we lift it up and we want to, you know, fiddle with it, to do something, to open this application or that application.
And while we suffer from fear of missing out.
Yes, so we need to, you know, continuously open it and look at it and find, and thereby we are becoming addicted to it. So
right.
Our children, they become addicted to it much more than us.
Right.
And they need, today, even grown-up people, they have find problems. When we're talking to each other, we're looking at the phone and we're not looking and paying attention to what's
being. So this digital addiction is one thing that parents need to be taking care of.
Parents need to lead by example. That when they're talking, for example, especially when you're in a meeting, when you're going to a gathering, you're going to a social event, then the best thing would be that the rules that should be made in the house, in that gathering, that phones off, please.
Okay.
Let's turn off our phones, or
wow.
Let's keep our phones outside.
Yeah.
Outside, let's keep a place in the house where all our phones are put. And we say, okay, within this 2 or 3 hours.
Like as we have here in the exercises or swimming sessions, you're not allowed to take phone from the very initial point you enter.
Exactly.
These halls of exercises or gyms or even the swimming pools, you really are not allowed to take your phones with you. So that's really a big moment. Like I personally have this experience that you, when you are there without phone, you really kind of think about yourself. You have more self-awareness. You get to know more about yourself, who I am, and you come out of that digital addiction.
Exactly. So you need to, one thing is doing it by making rules and enforcing it by, for example, you're going to a meeting and nowadays these gadgets, they become through this phone tapping is going on. Even if you're not using the phone, this gadget can be used as an eavesdropper. People can, you know, come and they can listen to what you're saying.
So exactly.
Insensitive, when you're talking about sensitive issues, even family issues, it would be much recommended that this phone is kept out of it, because
right.
Anybody can hack your phone and come to become a participant in your
right.
discussion. So
right.
These are the downsides. So you need to enforce principles and rules to you somehow get rid of this. Secondly, you need to learn self-restraint and teach your children to develop this self-restraint. For example, sometimes every time we pass the fridge, we want to open it up and find something in it and pick it up and eat it.
Eat something.
So that temptation is there, even in elders. So how do we, stop that habit? Stop that happening, that we're nibbling all the time, eating something here and there, and that's going to make us fat, for example. So we need to, for example, regulate our times for eating. We're not going to eat between these times, for example.
Right.
And secondly, even when we're tempted to open the fridge and our hands are moving towards something which we find sumptuous and we want to drink it or eat it,
right.
The moment our hand is going, we should stop ourselves
okay.
and close the fridge. So if we do that, we can learn how to, you know, remove these bad habits. And the same goes with the phone. We stop ourselves if we are tempted to go and pick up the phone, and so immediately we should put it down.
Right, right. So, and so goes right with the digital tech, which has many positive impacts, but at the same time, if it leads to an addiction, it could negatively impact the teenager's physical and mental upbringing, his academic performance, and can actually interfere in the sleep patterns and also reduce the amount of time that he spends in exercising and outdoor activities. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.